The third and final case on today's oral argument calendar is case number A24-55, Laverne Allen Harris versus Reno Lindell. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Appellant's counsel, you may approach the lectern. Please state your name and the name of your client, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stephanie Schomer, and I represent the appellant Laverne Harris, who is in the courtroom with me today. The facts of this case are a classic example of why we have the Findon factor test. Three of the factors, in my opinion, were clearly met, and I'm going to spend a brief amount of time on factors three and four, and probably most of my time on factors one and two. Now, I understand I do have an uphill battle because the district court said I didn't meet any of them, but as I go through them, I can comfortably state for the court that I do think that every factor was met.
Did you say three factors were clearly met?
Yes.
And which one was not clearly met?
I think the biggest question before the court is reasonable excuse. I think that there was a lot of time spent by the district court and in the briefs also on debatably meritorious, but I do think that we clearly met debatably meritorious as well.
Okay.
So let me start with due diligence. The district court analysis of this issue was an abuse of discretion because the court did not count from the date when the problem was actively discovered. Also, the district court analysis was lacking substantial findings that we did not act with due diligence. So the question is, did my office act promptly? On June 8th was the first time that we recognized that we were coming up to the one-year filing deadline. On the 15th is when we actually found out what the one-year filing deadline was. On that same day, we filed the case with the court. I think that the due diligence factor, the best cases to support our position are Conley and Findon. In both cases, it can be argued that their counsel, the original counsel, didn't act appropriately. So in Conley, we have that the prior attorney completely failed to answer. There was a summary judgment motion, and the attorney said he would reply and never did.
Are you speaking of Cornell?
I have Conley.
Conley,
yep.
Okay. With a C?
With a C. It's a 1982 case before the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
So when the client found out that his attorney hadn't done any of the work and the case was removed, you know, under Rule 60, they immediately hired a new attorney and moved to get the case reinstated. Same with Findon. The Findon attorney, the original attorney, didn't file an answer. There was really no work done on the case. The client hired a new attorney, and that's why we have the four Findon factor test, which is established law. The second part of due diligence is, did we move with due diligence after we found out of the issue? So under Rule 60 relief, we moved within 40 days of the actual knowledge and 34 days after the defendant's motion to dismiss. So there's case law specifically on this. That's the Black case, that if a relief is sought within 3 months, that's due diligence. That's the Black case. And then the Thomas case is also 35 days. I'm going to move on to substantial prejudice. Both the district court.
Just so we're clear that when it comes to due diligence, the district court considered the option between the argument that there was only a 6-day delay and then the delay to or failure to act, beginning April of 2023 rather than June of 2023. The district court seems to set out those were the options that were provided based on the arguments of the parties. Is that an accurate characterization? Those were the two options that were presented?
Yes, I do think that that's what the district court ordered. And but that's an abuse of discretion because the case law is counting from the day of the actual knowledge. And the actual knowledge wasn't until June 8th. Or that's when we knew there was a problem. The 15th, okay, there is a problem. It was filed on the 9th.
So the district court's reasoning, you argue, is improper when it based it on, I guess, your awareness of the case in 2023.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And the strongest case in that, in support of that is what?
Yep. So the due diligence, I cited Conley and Findon for those propositions of how quickly you need to move for due diligence, but then also Black, that is 3 months is due diligence from the date of dismissal.
I mean, does Black set forth a rule of law that 3 months is always sufficient, or was that just simply the facts of that case?
Yeah, I think that that court obviously took all the facts of that case. I mean, any Findon analysis is very fact intensive. So all of the facts within that case, and they believe that it was due diligence.
Okay, thank you.
So moving on to substantial prejudice, both the district court and the respondent also used the wrong standard and measured from the date of the actual incident, appellant slip and fall, instead of the date of dismissal to present. So the proper date is when the case was dismissed to present, and that is the Cornell case with the C. This case was dismissed in November of 2023. It's only been 6 months. Here, the only prejudice is added expense and delay. There's no evidence before this court or in the district court that we're not able to call the same witnesses or the same evidence. I'm going to move on to debatably meritorious.
You're saving for last the one that's the closest question.
Huh? Yep. I'll move faster.
Okay.
Debatably meritorious. I think that this factor is clearly met and an abuse of discretion. The biggest cases on point are Cole and Charson, and that is that we must provide specific information, not conclusory. So the district court set the bar too high, I believe more akin to a summary judgment Rule 56 standard. The district court said that we needed to provide the district court with medical records and photographs, which I respectfully disagree with. The appellant must establish only one debatably meritorious claim. The case for that is Cole. The complaint alleged negligence and negligence per se. I will say that I do think the complaint in this case was well written. It went through establishing that appellant lived at the residences that was owned by defendant and that it had snowed. There was precipitation, the entrance to appellant's where he resided, and that there was, it was not cleared. And so that meant negligence. And then the negligence per se is that it wasn't cleared within a reasonable amount of time per Mille Lacs City Code. And then also that there were various statutory violations.
So counsel, what are the elements of a negligence claim?
So the, you're testing my torts, which I should really know, but it's really that there is a relationship and then there's a breach. In this case, it was that there was a relationship between the parties. The appellant was a tenant, and that the negligence in this case was that the owner of the structure of the building did not reasonably clear snow and ice, and that the harm that happened to appellant is one for which the, in this case, there's ordinances and so city code and also building code, that the injury suffered is that would why the rule was enacted. So in this case, my client injured his shoulder due to the fall.
Okay, but I think the complaint stated that he suffered, quote, injuries to his right shoulder and other parts of his body.
Yes.
And that he endured pain and suffering.
Yes.
How is that enough to show an injury?
Well, the injury was shown. I mean, that's what's claimed in pretty much every personal injury complaint, you know, a summary of what the injuries are. And then the parties did exchange medical records as well.
Are those part of the record, though?
They're not part of the district court record, no.
Okay, so what is in the record then that you can point to show that there's a meritorious claim that would have allowed you to prevail at trial? Sure. Because that isn't that the standard?
Well, I respectfully disagree, that because the standard is that we have to provide specific information, and that information in the complaint is enough. That is Cole and Charson.
Right. So what's the I'm struggling. This is one I'm actually struggling with, just to be, you know, yep. Speaking for myself, because you have to come forward with specific information.
Yes.
A general allegation of an injury doesn't seem specific enough. It seems like you need to have more of what the actual injury was. Saying an injury to a shoulder and other parts of his body, I'm struggling with whether or not that actually meets the standard there.
Yeah, and I think, Your Honor, that you're thinking of this in a way like a Rule 56. So as long as we provide specific information of the injury, and then the answer also helped with this. I mean, the answer confirmed that the
is that in the record, though?
The complaint and the answer.
Yes.
Yes.
The complaint is, I know, but
yes, the answer is in the district court record.
And what does it say in the answer?
Well, what helps me with the answer is that the respondent said that he owned the property and that the handrail and the railing were
right. Parked. I understand that part, but I'm struggling with the injury part, whether or not that element of a negligence claim is met here in terms sure. of being able to provide and point to specific information of that injury.
Yep, and respectfully, I don't believe it's necessary, because we provided specific information that he sustained those injuries, and we provided medical records through authorizations to the defense showing what his injuries are through initial disclosures, and the discovery started.
Right, but didn't the district court also have an issue with whether or not the medical records were in the record? I mean, because we're limited to what's presented in the record as to whether or not there actually is.
Yes.
I didn't see it in the record. I looked at the addendum. There's a reference to the records, but I didn't see any records, medical records attached. It just says medical records of treatment. It makes a reference to it, but then it says that they weren't there, or the damages for that matter either.
They were pled in the complaint, and per Cole and Charson, that's what's necessary. We provided specific information. And then just moving on as well.
But
and
just it, to be clear, the yes. medical records are not in the record that's before us.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Before the district court when it made its decision on this, correct?
That's correct. And I don't feel like it's necessary. All we need to provide the court is with specific information that's non-conclusory. We also submitted the expert affidavit.
That's what I'm struggling with. This doesn't sound like specific information that's non-conclusory. It seems, you know, just to say that there was an injury, that sounds conclusory without having specific information supporting that.
And again, I think Your Honor, respectfully, it's looking at this more like a Rule 56 motion. We can look at Rule 12 and you know, Rule 60 relief, and we just need to provide specific information. We also provided the affidavit of our expert, and an expert affidavit is enough to show factor one. That's the Peterson v. Scott case.
Not an affidavit of the injury. That's an affidavit of the status of the
violation of
the negligence code. And negligence per se. Correct. Yes.
But even with negligence per se, you still have to meet the elements of negligence.
Yes, which we believe were met in this case through the complaint, which per the case law, Charson and Cole is enough. I'm going to move on to reasonable excuse. And I just want to say that Findon and Conley are cases on point. As I previously discussed with due diligence, both cases involved incompetent attorneys that did not do work on a file. And my time is up. Is it just okay if I finish my sentence?
Sure.
And then they found new counsel, and the Rule 60 motions were reversed. So with that, I believe we have met all factors.
Thank you, Ms. Schammer. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Please state your name and your client's name, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Milena Morozik, and I represent respondent Reno Lindell. A district court's decision whether or not to grant a Rule 60.02 motion for relief should not be reversed on appeal except for a clear abuse of discretion. That standard cannot be met unless the appellant can show that all four of the Findon factors are met. Appellant's counsel just argued to you a moment ago that she believed that three of the four factors were clearly met, and I think that sort of speaks for itself, and it's an admission that at least one of the four factors was not clearly met. And so I think that that goes to her being unable to show that there was a clear abuse of discretion.
Well, I understood the argument to be that, you know, three of them are clearly not met. The fourth is one that certainly is debatable, which is, I think, why we're here.
Yes, Your Honor. And I agree with that. And I think that just goes to the case law says that it needs to be a clear abuse of discretion. And so I would argue that if one of those factors is not clearly met, there can't really be a clear abuse of discretion by the district court.
Speaking of the standard of review, I mean, for these Rule 60 cases, generally, the request should be liberally granted. And there's a lot of case law that talks about that, and we've had a number of cases with these. It seems like the district court took a very, very narrow view of these factors and seemed to take a very narrow construction of how much time, whether actions were reasonable, and particularly in a situation here in which you have a person who had a lawyer who ended up being disbarred and didn't take action, which is very similar to the whole Findon case itself. It seems a little disconcerting that narrow view that's taken when usually these are fairly liberally granted, assuming that the parties show that they've been diligent and there's not going to be any prejudice to the other party. So why didn't the district court clearly abuse its discretion here?
To respond to that question, I think that generally these are liberally granted when there's no fault at all on the party, him or herself. And I think the reason that the district court took maybe a more harsh approach on this case is because there was neglect that could be attributed to the appellant himself.
And what was that neglect?
I would argue that neglect would be, and I think the district court agreed with me here, that on April 21st of 2023, appellant knew that his initial counsel, attorney Kira, was about to be suspended, or maybe even Kira might have told him that he was already suspended, but he knew on that date, and he waited 49 days to take any action in the case. He contacted an attorney Schomer, on April 21st. At that time, he had the entire case filed.
That's not 49 days, though. That's really shortly after finding out that his current attorney was not going to be able to represent him anymore.
Sure, he contacted a new counsel almost immediately. If we agree,
why is that fault of appellant?
Because he never retained counsel until 55 days later. He didn't retain counsel until June 15th, 2023.
Right, but he still was engaging counsel to look into the issue of what is going on here now that his other counsel couldn't represent him anymore. That seems like, I don't see how that is unreasonable for a person to do that. And I mean, because I understand where you're coming from in terms of technically he didn't actually hire him until early June, but outside counsel was still retained to look at the issue. It wasn't like he was just sitting on his rights and thinking, well, you know, I hope, you know, manna falls from heaven at some point and resolves this issue for me. There was actually action taken by Palantir.
Yes, there was action taken, and I don't disagree with that. I think what the district court also looked at and what case law supports that the district court can look at is that there was also no active litigation going on in this case since its conception. Attorney Schomer argues that discovery had started, but the fact of the matter is we served discovery in July of 2022, and we received no responses to those discovery requests.
Okay, that goes to the fault of counsel, and we usually, under Rule 60, we don't attribute the fault of outside counsel to the client.
I think generally we don't attribute the fault to outside counsel, but there is case law that suggests that fault can be imputed to the client for an attorney's inaction in a case. And that case law is actually found, it's Cornell versus Ripka, which appellant cited. And that case clearly stated that in some circumstances, it may be appropriate to impute some fault to the client for a lengthy period of time in which a case does not move forward at all. In this case, there was no movement for 316 days. The first movement was the summons and complaint going out.
Right, but all this still occurred before the deadline, the 1 year deadline.
Yes.
So I mean, in the cases that I've seen, usually the delay pushes it past the deadline, whatever deadline that was not met. That's not the situation here.
It's not. This situation is unique in that there was no movement on the case at all. Then the deadline comes and then movement starts. So
right. And in fact, the day that they were the new outside counsel was retained was the day shortly after they found out that the deadline either had passed or would pass. The day that they were retained is the day they actually filed the complaint. So from that perspective, there's like no delay there at all. Right.
I agree that there's no delay in when they found out, but I think that this going now, I think more towards the reasonable excuse to counsel that new counsel for appellant had an opportunity to discover that action needed to be done to preserve her client's case well before June 15th. She had the entire case file, albeit missing the affidavit of service, on April 21st of 2023. And had she looked at those papers, she would have noticed that the complaint was dated May 24th of 2022, and had answered on June 6th.
Right, but didn't the district court clearly abuse its discretion by looking at the wrong dates in terms of determining reasonableness, determining due diligence, determining what, if any, delay had occurred?
I don't believe that the district court abused its discretion in looking at the dates in terms of reasonableness. I think reasonableness goes to the entirety of the case from when the complaint was served to when the deadline was passed and what happened thereafter. I don't necessarily disagree that in terms of the diligence factor, perhaps the date should have been the date that the complaint was missed. I still believe that diligence wasn't shown even if that's the time of calculation. And I think prejudice perhaps is calculated around that date as well. And I still don't think that the district court abused its discretion if it found that prejudice existed after that date.
And what is the prejudice other than the typical delay?
The prejudice here is that we can't rely on the same evidence and the same witnesses because we were never informed who those witnesses were. It's now six years, since this incident happened. And we've never had a signed statement from appellant himself as to what he believes occurred. And we've never had him identify witnesses. We've never had the opportunity to obtain medical records. We've never had the opportunity to go out and look at the ramp with his counsel present to see exactly what issues they took there. We don't know if there still exists photos of the ramp and its condition at that time. And even if we calculate prejudice in terms of lost memories in those 45 days, with each day that passes, because this happened in 2018, the memories of potential witnesses fade more and more each day. So even an additional 45 days from when this action was deemed dismissed is prejudicial to us in that the witnesses aren't going to have the same memories they had in 2018 or 45 days before that deadline expired.
What about the debatably meritorious claim?
I think that appellant's use of case law is misconstrued in that the Supreme Court has never specifically stated that you can rely on merely conclusory allegations in the complaint. Oftentimes, the parties rely on affidavits or other proof, and that comes from the Grunke versus Kloskin case. And in this case, there simply wasn't any affidavit submitted by appellant. There wasn't any additional proof submitted. The only thing we have to rely on and look at is the complaint and the affidavit of the expert, which was also conclusory statements, in my opinion.
What about the answer? Counsel pointed to the answer as well as the complaint itself.
And I would argue our answer is also conclusory, and we simply respond to what we're given. And our answer, we don't have the burden of proving appellant's case, so our answer isn't really what should go to whether or not the appellant can show that he has a debatedly meritorious claim.
Just to be clear on that, you're not suggesting that admissions in an answer would not be part of the equation as to meritorious nature of a complaint?
I'm not suggesting that the admissions shouldn't be considered to the extent that they are in the answer. I'm just stating that I don't believe that our answer is what should be required to establish a debatedly meritorious claim. I believe it can be considered an addition, but I think the burden is on appellant.
Why isn't alleging an injury sufficient to meet the standard under Rule 60?
To be quite honest, although I think that the case law does support that there isn't a debatedly meritorious claim, this is a factor I would be willing to concede. I think that the standard is somewhat muddled, and I don't necessarily agree that appellant should be punished on such a harsh reading of that. So I would be willing to concede that. And even if I concede that point, the issue is that appellant still needs to prove that all four of those factors are met. And so even if there is a debatedly meritorious claim, the remaining factors aren't met. And therefore, the district court's decision should not be overturned on appeal.
So would you agree with appellant that the closest call, well, what do you think is the closest factor, and do you agree with appellant in terms of the was it the reasonable excuse one?
I think the closest factor and the closest meaning that appellant should win or be able to prove that, I think, would be the debatedly meritorious claim.
Stated differently, what's your best argument for affirmance?
I think my best argument for affirming this is the reasonable excuse. I just don't think if we consider all the facts and circumstances of this case and the actions of all three parties involved, Attorney Kira, Attorney Schomer, and appellant himself, I don't think that he can show that there's a reasonable excuse in failing to meet the deadline. And close second to that, I believe, would be the diligence factor. If I may, on the diligence factor, I think appellant is arguing that he acted within 6 days of finding out that the action was dismissed, but I think the diligence factor should actually assess how long it took for appellant to take action to get his case reinstated, and that was much longer than 6 days. At the time that appellant knew that this case was automatically deemed dismissed under 5.04, that'd be June 9th, he should have immediately filed the Rule 60.02 motion. There's no case law to support that he could not have immediately filed the Rule 60.02 motion. In fact, there's case law that says that there need not be any action by a court, the district court, to dismiss under Rule 5.04 before Rule 60.02 can be brought. And so I think that should have immediately been brought, and that would have shown diligence. But rather, appellant waited until we moved to dismiss the action officially, and then 2 days before we were going to argue on our motion to dismiss, served a Rule 60.02 motion for relief. And so I don't believe that shows diligence. And even if we calculated it on the 6 days, there is case law to support that this court has previously held that even responding 9 days after receiving notice of default wasn't due diligence.
There's also case law talking about, you can file that Rule 60 even after a default judgment, and that's the posture we often see these cases. So the deadline has been completely blown. Oftentimes it's been a while, and it's only when a party moves for a default judgment that they respond, either because they didn't know what was going on or, you know, the loss of papers, mm-hmm. and et cetera, et cetera. So these can actually occur much, much later.
I do agree that they can occur, but there is no per se rule that if you take action to seek a Rule 60.02 motion within that 1 year time frame, that you are automatically deemed to have been diligent. And so I think that if you look at the timing and the fact that appellant waited until we took action when they didn't need to, that shows that there wasn't due diligence, because they could have served that 60.02 motion when they filed the summons and complaint officially. In closing, I think that if you look at our brief and you look at the entire circumstances of this case, I don't believe that there is a clear abuse of discretion from the lower court in finding that not all four of the factors were met. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Schaumer, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to spend my time on reasonable excuse.
Can I start by asking, so the district court wrote a full page of analysis of this issue, single space. There's a lot of reasons there. Is there anything in that long paragraph that is factually inaccurate?
Your Honor, talking specifically about reasonable excuse.
Right, paragraph 8 of the order on pages 5 and 6. That's the paragraph devoted to the second requirement.
Yeah, I do think that one thing that I disagree with regarding the district court's paragraph 8 in particular is that
I guess my question is whether there's anything factually inaccurate. I mean, whether the district court properly understood the record.
I think the district court properly understood the record, but one thing the district court pointed to was that specifically my phone call with Mr. Rakowski, who is the co-counsel for respondent, that I didn't mention it in my brief. I did say in the declaration that I did send an email to Mr. Rakowski on April 21st, specifically saying, I have heard from a Mr. Harris. It looks like you're the counsel. I have not signed a retainer. Can you let me know what's going on with the case?
Because you are not representing Mr. Harris, then he had no obligation to respond, right?
No, he didn't. But it would have helped me get a understanding of what was happening in the case.
And you next followed up a month and a half later, I think.
Yes, yes. And I could have followed up more often, I think. But I did,
sooner.
Yeah, or sooner, I should say.
Because you had a copy of the complaint in your file with a signature date in the month of May.
Yes, I did. But I still didn't know if the case had been filed. I think I did look it up, and it didn't look like it had. But I really had no information. I didn't have a lot of the medical records. I really didn't know what was going on in the case. And so finally, we were able to make contact on the 8th. And that was the first time that I had heard specifically what was going on with the case and that we might be reaching the deadline.
I mean, the district court, I'm looking now at the middle of page 5, states it's unclear why plaintiff did not retain attorney Schaumer until June 15. So I think what the district court is saying is that, the district court did not have, we don't know whose fault that was of postponing the retention.
Sure.
But in the absence of information, I guess the district court, I think, used the absence of information against you.
Yes, I agree. I do think, Your Honor, that the district court put blame on me, and I understand. I think the biggest blame that I would get was not following up sooner with Mr. Rakowski. I felt like in order to sign a retainer with appellant that I needed more information on the case, that I wanted to speak with the defense counsel to know what part of the litigation we were in. I do want to move on if possible, unless I...
Move on to what?
So just some other factors with reasonable excuse. I think that, respondent did talk about that the case had not been actively litigated, and I respectfully disagree. there was a joint discovery plan signed by the attorneys. There were initial disclosures signed by Mr. Karat, the disbarred attorney, and he did send medical authorizations to respondent so that respondent could get copies of appellant's medical records. So I think that's akin, it is an unpublished case, but to the Perez v. AFA, A-F-F-A case, you know, similar facts. There was a joint discovery plan, exchange of medical records, but no depots or formal discovery had happened. I think that this case is different from the others because the Findon and Conley cases are so on point. I think that there's a huge public policy argument to be made here as well. I think it's disheartening to hear that the appellant is being put some of the blame on him. I did cite cases in my brief that the Hamilton and Sanborn cases, that substitution of counsel cases when they happen within a couple of months is completely reasonable. And that's exactly what happened here. I mean, honestly, what attorney would take over a case for a client who had a prior disbarred attorney if this district court decision were upheld? And I thank you for your time.
The Supreme Court has said in Cole, which is a case about the one-year dismissal, right?
Yes.
That there are no per se rules of law, that this is, you know, every case is, the decision is fact intensive. The decision must be based on the surrounding facts of each specific case and is committed to the sound discretion of the district court. And I think that's with respect to the second requirement.
Yes, I agree, but I also think that Cole also says that even when the actions of the attorney are inexcusable, they're loath to punish the party that case has been.
I think Cole said that, and then it said, but it's a matter of discretion for the district court.
It is.
And there's no per se rules of law. I mean, in other words, there is a, I agree, these two concepts are maybe not easily separated, but on the one hand, we don't want to punish clients for the mistakes of their attorneys, but on the other hand, there's no per se rules of law. So in other words, I think one way to reconcile that is to say that that is a suggestion to district courts when exercising their discretion about specific cases to keep that in mind, but yet if that's a question of discretion for the district court, if that's a consideration the district court may apply, but that it might operate differently here at the Court of Appeals. Do you have any response to that observation?
Yeah, my response to that is Findon and Conley, because those two cases are just so on point, where there is an attorney that just didn't work on the file as much as they should have. They didn't answer. They didn't reply to a summary judgment motion. And the attorney acting in that manner, the client relying that they thought that their attorney would be doing due diligence and work on the file was a reasonable excuse. And then the Findon factors are met and the case needs to be put back on the docket.
Okay. Thank you for your arguments. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. That is the final case on today's oral argument calendar, so the court is now adjourned.